Welcome to the Futile Podcast. Tonight, we got Zach and Ian, and we're going to talk about David Fincher's film, Zodiac. So, when this film came out, I really wanted to see it, because it was a Fincher film, and he hadn't done one in kind of a while, I think. I think Zodiac was the first he did since Panic... No. Was it since Panic Room?
Probably.
Yeah, so it was a really long time. Because I had seen Fight Club at the theater, I saw Panic Room at the theater, wasn't that impressed with Panic Room, and wanted to see something new from him, and, well, then a long time went by. I didn't end up getting to see it at the theater, and then I heard that he was going to, that they released the DVD, and then I heard they were going to do a director's cut, and I was like, you know what, if I'm going to watch this movie, I want to watch it, like, as much of it as I can. So I waited, and then eventually... I guess I just bought it on Blu-ray. One of the few Blu-ray purchases sight unseen. Just now watched it for the first time. And you had seen it before. You talked about how you like it. You know, you're a Fincher fan. I think one of the first times we ever were hanging out was years ago. And we all sat at like... it was like at Steven's like sister's apartment and watched The Game like on a tiny TV. Because, like, they had power in Arcata, right. And the power had been out for, like, a while, like, in McKinleyville and Fieldbrook and everywhere else. So that was a weird sort of thing. But that was a cool movie. I like that. I got that on DVD. Probably watch that again pretty soon here.
Yeah, I need to watch The Game again.
Okay, well, we can make it Fincher Fridays or something.
Yeah.
And do The Game and 7, too. I've still got that. I'd like to rewatch that, too, at some point. Anyway, yeah, so this is about the Zodiac killings that happened in San Francisco in the late 60s, early 70s. It's got Jake Gyllenhaal, Robert Downey Jr., Mark Ruffalo, Anthony Edwards, Philip Baker Hall.
Dermot Mulroney.
Elias Koteas.
Donald Logue.
Donald Loge. Donald Loge's sister is briefly in it. Fans of Terriers will note that that's her. I really liked the movie. Honestly, I didn't think I wouldn't. I mean, I'd listened to some
Chloe Sevigny.
Yeah, Chloe Sevigny as well. I'd listened to some podcast reviews about it, and it kind of convinced me that it was something I probably would really dig. So, because of like what I'd heard in reviews and just sort of seen in bits and pieces, I thought, well, this is like an investigative. Kind of neo-noir-y story. It's set in a cool time period. I really like...
You like any time period that's not now?
No, I don't, actually.
Because you've already told me that you like the Art Deco period.
Well, I like...
You like trains
and lobbies and things.
But this was like...
This was 68.
This was late 60s, early 70s San Francisco, which is nothing like any of that.
Not really, but there are some places where it's
so
still cool
looking. You like the stuff that looks like Ron Burgundy's house.
I think Ron Burgundy's was like a 70s thing, right? Like a late 70s. See, that's the thing. Once it gets into late 70s, I don't really... Like, parts of Ron Burgundy's house are okay. I'll give you that. I'm also, like, really not, like, an expert about architecture and art design, necessarily, so...
You just know what you like.
I mean, if I say I like Art Deco-y stuff, I know what Art Deco-y looks like, but I also know that there's, like, just modern. And modern looks cool, too. You know, 2001... Like chairs in the space station, like that to me is very cool. But that's not an Art Deco-y thing. That's like a modern sort of, I don't know what the term would be. It's not like Bauhaus or anything either. It's
Art Deco looks like everything from the movie The Shadow.
Yeah, I haven't seen that in a while. I'd kind of like to rewatch that. I think I remember kind of enjoying The Shadow.
Okay.
Yeah.
It spends too much time on Tim Curry.
Oh, maybe it does. But some people would say that that's a
like
strength.
Like 10 minutes.
10 minutes is too much, yeah. Tim Curry for you?
It was to the detriment of the film because he's such a goofy, like to me he's just so over the top that he's not even...
Okay, I'll give you that. So it took the like darkness out of it and it made it too goofy.
Not that it was so dark anyway. It had a great score. I liked the score a lot to it.
I don't remember. Okay, I should. I mean, I can get that for cheap on DVD.
You could probably get it for like a dollar on Amazon.
I'll look. I'd buy it for cheap, for sure.
Your brother could probably get it for you on VHS.
Yeah, god damn it. Anyway, yeah, so...
He got you with that one, didn't he?
He thought he did.
Did he say, I got you?
He thought he did, but here's the thing. Like I found someone that wants to take it off my hands.
What?
Who? For real. Josh. Josh is going to take it.
On VHS?
Yeah, I told him.
He wants Titanic on VHS.
He said he'd been watching a lot of VHSs lately, and I'm like, you want Titanic on widescreen on VHS? And he's like, yeah, sure.
Wow. What a sucker.
No,
a sucker
no.
Born every minute.
No. Probably just, you know... Give it to
someone. Where did Seth get Titanic on VHS?
I don't even know. I kind of want to know. I don't want to like delve into that too far and find
out. You don't want to know.
I don't like, want to know.
There was some sort of dirty task that he undertook.
Or like it'll get him thinking about going back there and doing more. My birthday's coming up, see?
1981. So.
Yeah, so I'm going to be 30. I'm looking forward.
2 days before my mom's birthday.
Crazy.
Weird.
I know.
It's weird how things work.
It is, right?
Thinking about becoming a Kabbalist now.
You're going to get the little red string?
Yeah. These numbers are too insane.
Then you're just a numerologist once you start doing that.
Kabbalists. That's what Kabbalists are, except for they're mystics.
Oh, like in Pi?
I don't know if that was about Kabbalah. I haven't spent so long since I've seen Pi.
There is a part where like a bunch of like something, some mystical group or something. Right. I think that they were Jewish guys.
Well,
you know, I don't know if it was
Kabbalah came into it came in vogue when people like Perry Farrell and Madonna kind of got into it. I believe in like the late 90s, early 2000s. I don't remember. I don't know if they still consider themselves Kabbalists or not. But I always thought it was like, oh, this is really trendy. But it's super old. It's a really, 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 really old Jewish mysticism.
Yeah.
That like you know Orthodox Jews never took part of, but. They were always, you know, very considerate numbers. Umberto Eco's books, The Name of the Rose, and it doesn't talk about Kabbalists, but it talks about, it's the old Catholic Church and, you know, the Benedict. Have you ever seen the movie?
Parts of it, Christian Slater and
Sean Connery. Yeah, so, I mean, it's about Benedictine monks and, and they're very, there's this long conversations they have with the person, the bishop or whatever, this abbey, that they're staying at, and they have long conversations about numbers and why certain numbers are good and certain numbers are bad, and certain numbers, when you add them up, become a holy number, like 3 or 7. And they explain why those are holy and why those are important. And essentially, any number you give them, they can tell you why it's a good number. Because essentially, you can turn any number into a good
numerology,
number.
Numerology,
But, I mean, when it's used for the religious purposes like that, and then a really fascinating book he wrote called... Foucault's Pendulum, which is about these three editors at this they publish, it's a vanity press, they publish stuff, people come and they convince them to pay them to print their stuff for them, and so the editors of that, like they print their own magazine that essentially gets them all excited about all these conspiracies. They plug a bunch of conspiracies into a new computer that they get. And this, I don't know when this is written, early 80s, something like that. Mm-hmm. So computers are a brand new thing. And, or maybe the late 80s, mid 80s. But, essentially they create a master conspiracy theory about the whole earth and like alchemy and all this stuff. And it starts pulling people out of the woodworks. Like people hear of their theory and like read about it in this book they're publishing, and it starts becoming this really dangerous thing where people are like dying and stuff because of people coming up who are saying they're like immortals and stuff like that, who've been searching for these answers that they've come up with.
That's so crazy.
It's awesome. It's awesome. But there's tons of time spent in that book talking about Kabbalism, and they talk about how like old and like. I don't know if you ever read about stuff like the Rosicrucians and the Knights Templar and all the.
I know a little bit about the Templar. That's always thrown into everything.
It was all about alchemy, and the search for the Holy Grail was really the search for something they thought was going to be some sort of like weapon that would work in their favor or allow them to be alchemists, like to turn things into gold.
The
like
Philosopher's this, Stone.
Exactly, the Philosopher's Stone. Yeah. And so, it's just, I don't know, a lot of stuff's really interesting to me, but...
No, that's cool, that's cool. Definitely.
Actually, it's very similar to a lot of things in Zodiac.
Absolutely.
Because Zodiac is so much about whether or not there's meaning in like anything. And I mean, all these people have different jobs and they're all, you know, it's all about something that's happened, but like they struggle so hard to find meaning in it, and one by one they drop off from this thankless task when they start to realize that their lives are being consumed by it.
And yeah,
it's about a, you know, the obsession over that sort of thing, and that's just what's really fascinating to me about it.
Yeah, definitely. It's got an interesting structure in that sense. You know, at first you think maybe it's going to be about one set of characters investigating, maybe, and then it sort of becomes about another set. I mean, it's sort of like this report, investigative reporting thing that starts to hint at the beginning,
right.
And then it switches over to the cops. And then at the end, for like almost the last 45 minutes or hour, it's all about the cartoonist
who was
sort of there the whole time.
I mean, and that's the thing, is that, like, you know, the one who really comes down to it, and, you know, is the one who had like the least gain from it at all, and you know, who essentially solves the thing in the end with his tireless and, you know, investigation of it.
Yeah,
he had nothing to gain. He had nothing to gain at all. The rest of them, it was their jobs. You know, they in Paul Avery's case. The reporter, you know, it was something where they could it would increase circulation and his popularity and so on and so forth. But I mean, all those people end up dropping off, and everyone, you know, the Anthony Edwards character, and everyone just can't hang with it anymore.
Yeah, can't be on call all the time.
And I don't know. I mean, I, not having lived through that time, I can't really. You know, I remember when I was in my last days living in LA, when maybe like 87 or 88 or something like that, the Night Stalker was a big deal. Richard Ramirez, mm-hmm. and he crawled into people's homes on the quiet streets in LA and murdered people and raped people. And
jeez.
And, you know, I don't know how many he actually ended up killing, 6, 7, something like that. But like the idea of a serial killer is usually like they're really twisted, diseased people.
Absolutely.
And what ends up happening is that this, you know, pervasive fear overtakes the city, and it becomes emblematic of like the era. And that's the one thing that I think, that's why I was telling you when we did the podcast after Fight Club, or maybe it was after Social Network, right? Obviously, because I think we watched Fight Club before Social Network, right?
After. I just listened to the Fight Club podcast. Yeah.
But, you know, one of the things...
Fincher being cold and this being the perfect stuff for...
Well, not necessarily cold, but the idea that Social Network and Zodiac are more alike than any of his other films is because they're completely emblematic of an era, and they give you the feeling of, you know, everyone's mood due to whatever. And, you know, there's no sense of, like, any sort of... He doesn't cloud it with, like, economic uncertainty or
Vietnam,
you know, they talk about all that stuff very briefly. There's that part where the movie goes black for like a minute, and you hear all those sound bites about things passing by, and it's like that doesn't matter, you know, like the stuff that actually matters was what was affecting these people and causing them to, you know, live a certain way and not put their kids on the school bus. And I don't know, you know, it's interesting. It's the type of thing where, like, I really do feel like the film's about not looking too hard for meaning, but then you start looking at, like, what's the meaning of the film?
Yeah.
And it's like, it's obviously slapping you in the face with that, but it's like, it works so well, despite the fact that it obviously doesn't really, it kind of gives you a conclusive answer.
But the resolution is not 100%, you know?
It's not, and it's not,
that's
it's not
true
meant
life,
to be.
And that's,
it's not
yeah,
meant
exactly.
to be. But it's also like, there's no real resolution for any of the characters either, except for Gyllenhaal, who's essentially kind of like
caught. That guy did it,
Well, not just that, but I mean, he's kind of destroyed his life to get to this point where he can just look a man in the eyes and feel. After all that, the whole thing about the film being about evidence and solving puzzles and having tangible things in front of you to piece together and proving with this and that, it comes down to him looking in a guy's eyes and feeling like he knows that the person did it or not, you know?
Yeah.
Like, it's just brilliant the way it's put together. I don't know. There's something about it that I really like.
Definitely. I mean, I think this is... I mean, I touched on this when we talked about The Social Network, and I talked about, like, you got David Fincher, and you got, you know, and all that. It's something where, like the quality of the material in Zodiac, the kind of story that it is, the sort of issues and themes and characters that are there, are to me much more gripping and more interesting. And so when Fincher does his Fincher thing with it, I'm much more into it. I mean, Social Network is a good movie, and I understand why everyone loves it. And I mean, I get all of the commentary on people and the modern society and all that to a degree. But this movie is just really, really good and really well made, and the art design is just so top notch. I kept pointing out, like, while we were watching it, probably annoyingly so, like, oh, look, there's an old squirt bottle, and oh, look, yeah. there's the old Pepto-Bismol right. or the old Coke machines and stuff. It's like, I don't know how much this movie cost to make. It must have been fucking expensive, because, digitally must have done some stuff in backgrounds to make it look like old San Francisco, and of course they did that. But, like most of the stuff is, like, there, you know? Mm. It's, I mean, that Coke machine is probably something they had to find, yeah. and... They got the American Pickers to go get it for him or something like that out of some guy's barn in Wisconsin.
Well, yeah, no, so, I mean, set design, production design, all that stuff was great and phenomenal, but I think that stuff really comes down to a demand for detail by someone who
yeah.
has to be. I mean, Fincher's always been details-oriented, and he's... You have to imagine that he's very exacting and demanding.
That's why I've wanted him to do another sci-fi. That's why I've wanted him to do more where that stuff seems to matter. Like, in Social Network, take it for what you will. It looks really good. But there was not a great call for it to have such a detail-oriented mind directing it. Because it takes place in essentially now. So it's not like... there, you know, not like you had to have someone that was like, oh, you know what, this should look this way because it's this time period, or it's this imaginative
world. But again, we've already talked about the fact that film is more about, that film's about people and yeah. not about a thing.
Yeah, that's true.
And his other films have been about a thing.
That's true. The performances are all really top-notch, too. Mm-hmm. All the pieces in this movie work, and it's such a almost difficult-to-define movie. I mean, through and through, I would say that it's pretty much like I kind of call it like sort of a neo-noir investigative story. And I mean, that's really what it is. It's just a detective story. But it's not got a lot of your typical tropes of a detective story. It switches investigators multiple times.
Yeah. And well, it's because it becomes like, you know, when they talk about how the main character, and I don't know if you've ever read any Sid Field books, but like... one of the books is always, it talks for a long time about the Robert Altman film Nashville.
Yeah.
And like, what do you notice about this after reading the whole thing? Well, the true main character is Nashville in the thing. It's stuff like
it's
that.
The city,
and this,
yeah.
it's like, it really is, the investigation of these murders is the thing you follow. It's
yep.
the protagonist, kind of, you know? Like, it's the through line, and it's the focus, and these characters are people swirling around it who kind of get sucked in to this thing and move along it, and where they are in the process is almost like unimportant, you know.
But they all serve their part
oh, for sure.
so well.
Yeah.
They all it's like all of these actors are performing with no ego. They're all like, okay, I'm here for these three scenes, and
yeah.
I'm important
well,
in these three
they,
scenes.
The casting is really good for the most part. I think the one character that kind of sticks out a little bit is played by Robert Downey Jr. Just because he is a more herky jerky look at being actor. Ruffalo sinks into the woodwork. Gyllenhaal is... the reason why he's so solid usually is because he's not over the top. I mean,
mm-hmm.
he can go, like... the second Prince of Persia... or the, not second, his mm-hmm. first one. I consider it a sequel to something because it's like every other Disney action film
yeah.
that I made. But it's... but there's a few times where he's like screaming and shaking his fist, and I think, gosh, he'd be great in a comedy where he just was like over the top
yeah,
furious.
Yeah.
But for the most part, he's just kind of there and he does his bug-eyed, shocked thing, and... and so it's like him and Tobey Maguire are like, you know,
yeah.
Gyllenhaal's like the Uber Maguire. It's kind of an evolution of that. But everyone else is like, they have really subtle performances. And Anthony Edwards is great, and I've never liked him. And
well, you've disliked Anthony Edwards in the past?
He just doesn't... well, first of all, my main, you know, of course, everyone knows him as Goose. And then you got...
the ER is the...
then you got ER. And ER, I hated him in. I thought he was the most self-righteous, annoying
really?
Character. And then being a hypochondriac, it's
yeah,
always
yeah.
bothered me that he died of a brain tumor. And he says goodbye to everyone, and then he says he's going off on an adventure. And then the last they show him, he's floating down a river, like, looking at things.
Yeah,
and
then
really
I think
cool.
they cut to a funeral or something.
No,
maybe.
No, he dies off in the woods.
Okay, that's the way to do it. I think I'm going to go up north when I'm ready.
Like Wolverine.
Like Wolverine, yeah. Going out like Wolverine.
But, you know, I forgot to mention Brian Cox.
Brian Cox, he was great.
And his
he's
was
always
more,
good. I like Brian Cox. Blustery kind
of. Like, yeah, but his, when he does that, like a really arrogant type of character, I don't know, he's always good, yeah.
I don't think I've disliked him in anything. I liked
I know you like Cox.
Delightful. Even Dermot Mulroney is pretty solid as the chief. Yeah. Though it does seem weird that he just doesn't feel like he's old enough to be like Ruffalo's chief.
He looked pretty grizzled.
Yeah, he looked grizzled.
You know, the weird thing about Dermot Mulroney is this. I've seen him in many movies. Yes. I'm sorry to keep doing all these asides.
I love this. This is great. This is the aside.
You see him in all these movies, and it always looks like he's got brown eyes. But up close, he's got, like, gray eyes. And it always bothers me. And not until he's, like, right up close can you see that his eyes are vampire-like.
Oh, my God. That's kind of scary to me. Maybe he's a vampire. No.
Unless, for some reason, they just gave him contacts in the film.
Yeah. Who knows? It's not... I don't know. It's kind of a tough-to-consume movie, but it's not for me because I love detective genre stuff. I love investigative stuff.
Was Dermot Mulroney the guy she falls in love with in Point of No Return?
Yes.
Okay, just
except he had, like, hippie hair and
I just think it was him, though, right?
Yeah, I think it was. Right, he had, like, hippie hair and stuff. Yeah.
What happened to her?
Bridget Fonda? Yeah.
What's the last thing she was in?
Not Jackie Brown, was it?
That was a long time ago.
That was a long time ago.
I don't know, man. All right, what were you saying? You were saying something important.
I was just trying to sort of bring it around to more with the... I had heard about this scene from people, or no, maybe I just read about it. The scene where the Transamerica building gets, they show it the time lapse, and I was looking forward to that. I thought they would have done it like during the credit sequence at the beginning or sometime when it would make sense to like.
It was a time to show. I mean, when it happened, it was a year lapse.
It was the way that they did it was weird though. Like they did it like so that it took a day.
I know you thought that you mentioned something like that during it, but I think that you.
It would have been really fucking weird if it had been like boom, 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 sun changing and stuff like that as fast to keep up with.
That's why they did it. I mean, first of all, it was fake, obviously.
I know it was fake, but I don't know. It almost felt to me like inserting, because it was digital, because it was fake, and you know that anyway. It almost felt to me like inserting like an animation interlude in a movie that was a little more
like
serious
Kill Bill.
Than that. No, well, yeah, well, to a degree, but the Kill Bill one was still part of the narrative. This was almost just like we've got to pass time, and so instead of like pulling like months off a calendar,
Harry Potter.
Yeah,
the new Harry Potter has an animation interlude in it.
It does?
Yeah.
Like a real anime, like something creative and cool?
Yeah, and the guy who did it, like, instantly got a huge film deal.
Oh, interesting.
And he's directing a bunch of stuff coming.
Well, that makes me much more interested to see it now if it's got an animation in it.
Yeah.
Because that seems like something I wouldn't have expected. So, I don't know, it's kind of a, kind of sticks out.
Did you like the lock shots on top of the taxi as it moved through? Looking down the taxis and move through the city before the taxi driver gets shot?
That first one? There was a couple more like that, yeah. I did like them. I liked them. Ah, gosh. I like them, but they also, like they draw themselves to be pointed out. They make an issue of themselves, like...
I think they were good because what we've always talked about is what kills a film like this is if you don't make the stakes real enough for everybody who's not the main characters.
Yeah.
It's why The Dark Knight and Batman Begins work, because you see a lot of citizenry.
Yeah.
And that's why Watchmen ultimately didn't kind of work, because you don't care about anyone that's not the main people, and they don't seem to care too much either about what happens. But you're hearing the things that tell why this is important, and you're hearing radio people, you're hearing people call about it. And so just having that stuff in the background while things are going on doesn't quite work. So you kind of have to have a way to show that stuff while something is going on. And that's it's a transition from one thing to another. It's going into a scene where it shows where a guy was driving. It's following like an actual route of a crime scene while you're getting this stuff that's filling you in on why this is important at the same time. That's why I think it is important. And he found a very interesting visual way to keep your attention while it's happening. Otherwise you could just kind of fade off while
that's true. I think, I was thinking more of the first the time I really noticed it was when it was the crime was actually being committed, that particular taxi drive, where it almost kind of like bird's eye viewed, like zoomed in on the city and followed the like route.
I'm talking about that there's like a 2 minute long part where the camera is looking directly down on top of the taxi, and when it turns exactly with it through the city, and then it parks, and then you cut to sideways, and then the guy leans forward and
shoots him. Yeah, that part. That's what we're talking about. We're talking about the same thing. Yeah, you're right. I don't remember there being much expositional information during that, was there?
It's not expositional. It's the part that's where frantic people are calling in, and then other
people. Oh, you're right. You're right. That's what it is. It's when people are the radio caller. Yeah,
it's putting the real public into the film. You know, it's drawing that into it, and it's making that.
That part of it is good, and you're right. It was a creative way to do that.
That's where I think his strengths with the genre stuff is. I think that's where it started to turn the corner, and I think that's where he maybe realized that I want to do more real stuff. I think he regressed when he went back to the Benjamin Button thing because it was a way to do a gimmicky thing in a way he thought was going to give him some sort of plaudits. But he still, like, you know, with The Social Network, the way he makes the twins out of the same guy and stuff like that, mm-hmm. which wasn't necessary, but he does it and it's fine, you know?
Yeah.
But, like, I think he's finding ways to funnel this creative energy into stories that are, like, about real things now.
No, I mean, but at the same time, the kind of story that the Zodiac film becomes, such a hodgepodge, sort of a mess in places, but it still, for the most part, works, I think is great because it does allow him to do those kind of creative things. Now, whether they all work for me or not is one thing. The Transamerica thing was kind of took me out of it, but I don't mind it. I think I was just really expecting it to be a certain way.
You could have had a good film by any director making that with say that same production.
If you have the same production team,
you've got the same writer, they end up with about the same script, you get the same actors, you could probably get a great film.
Yeah.
But what he does is a certain way stylistically that just kind of puts it over the top. I'm talking about camera angles. I'm talking about all the things that, I mean, there's the thing he does where there's, I mean, he does it in Seven, which is, you know, his early Here I Am type thing. Which is like the guy stands over him in the alley with a gun, and the body's kind of out of focus, and the gun's in focus in front. It's very similar to that shot in the beginning where the guy pops in through the in the car and shoots him out on Lover's Lane or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
And you can see the gun, you can see the light, and the body's kind of like out of view. Like he's it's like a close up shot of the gun. It's like certain angles. He does a lot of like lower angles looking at stuff. The tight shots on people really adds a lot of tension to it, like the people that are in the park,
yeah,
who are laying there, and you get suddenly this close up shots of their heads, and it's like a wide angle lens, and it's you know, he has a certain look that just works to make something that, you know, somebody like what's the guy who did that Before the Devil Knows Your Dad, the guy who died recently.
Oh, Lumet, Sidney Lumet.
Someone like that, you know, would have just shot really straightforward.
Maybe, I don't know. I've heard an interview with him talking about, like, 3 Days of the Condor, where he talked about certain lens choices he specifically made.
Lens choices or whatever. But what I'm 3 Days of the Condor is nothing special directorially. It's not. I mean, it's... visually.
Yeah.
You know, director, whatever. He is a good director. But what I'm saying is, the visual choices he makes in this film, I think, really adds something to what's going on. It adds to the tension.
Absolutely,
especially,
yeah.
You know, I mean, he knows how to shoot stuff to make it intense and feel like, you know, there's, I mean, the game is about nothing and it's still intense
all the way through.
You know?
Yeah. No, and it's just so clean. I mean, that's the thing about Fincher. It's like, even his dirty is clean, which is kind of artificial. I mean, it absolutely is artificial, but it's still, I still like it. You know, it's like, so what if he's doing a, you know, quote unquote, real story with real people, mm-hmm. and the break room at the factory when they first meet with the Lee character, or when they go to the Lee character's,
Trailer
and stuff, where it is. I mean, those are dingy places to a degree, and there's, like, you know, rusted, chipped paint and
right.
things like that. But it's still like I think the thing you talk about it, and it's either him or it's someone he's always working with that does the set design that is essentially just with him on such a level. but it's like everything's in its right place. The mess is still clean in that sense, you know what I mean? And it's not a criticism, it's just like his movies are just like more polished than just about anybody else's movies.
Right.
And it almost can detract when you're watching certain types of genre material or something, because it's just like it's constantly reminding you that it is a movie because of how polished it
looks. So you think Guy Ritchie should have directed it?
No, I'm not saying... you're right. It's so gritty because they literally digitally added grit to it or something.
Hey, Guy, what should we do with this set? Just throw paper all over the place. Wad up some paper and throw it
in. Yeah, wad up. Is there a lot of wadded paper?
I don't know. Just like every location in the first two films, and Sherlock Holmes also,
yeah,
is just loaded with dirt and grime and planks of wood and and bottles and
that's true.
Yeah, that's more true to life. And then the film was full of cartoonish action.
No, but I mean like the office for the Chronicle, like. It's almost the desks are all like organized right.
You don't think it would be like that in real life?
It's a serious place. No, you're right. You're right.
It didn't look high class. It had yellow paint.
It didn't look high class, but it.
Those desks were like the desk you see in the office of like some elementary school in like the 1980s or something.
Yeah. I don't know. Like I said, it's not a criticism. It's just
you sound like you're criticizing.
I really like it, but I just don't know if maybe it prevents him from making certain types of movies in the full way that they could be made because of that. I don't know. Like, I'd be interested to see him do something, and I hate to use the words I just made fun of, but something a little more gritty in that sense, like maybe where he spends a little less time making sure that everything's at a 90-degree angle or whatever, and that everything is like the clean polished like countertops
stuff. All of this is telling me that you still don't think Social Network is as good as people are claiming it is, because people are saying he's finally done it and people are saying he's finally got it and he knows how to make a film about people.
I'm saying he never didn't have that. I'm saying hell,
he never did it before. He tried with Benjamin Button and failed miserably.
I got stuff out of Benjamin Button if most people didn't. I got something my thing.
Ian got something that no one else got.
No, I'm not saying no one else got it, but my thing with that, I've never had that concern with Fincher that like, oh, he's so I was not until you started talking about it when we talked about Fincher, this sense that like, I guess critically he's considered sort of cold and about people and like that he doesn't do people right.
It's gimmicky clinical stuff up until you get to Benjamin Button. And then it's a problem because he pours on the schmaltz and he's still gimmicky and clinical.
What's gimmicky about that? He's mostly making genre-y movies though, right?
Everything's gimmicky.
Well, in like the daughter-mother relationship in Panic Room, or?
Panic Room is a high concept thing.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay? Fight Club is a high concept thing.
Yeah. So they're not about these like warm and fuzzy characters.
They're not about characters. They're about a thing.
Yeah.
They're all about a thing, and then you get to something that's supposed to be about a person, but it's still got a gimmick.
Okay, the criticism of Fincher then is that up until Benjamin Button is that he's only done movies that are about like ideas and not about characters.
He just doesn't he can't fully develop a good character, and his characters can't be taken seriously. I mean, the closest he's gotten is a soapbox chest beating Edward Norton in Fight Club.
Okay,
otherwise it's people who are just there as part of the plot.
I guess.
I
don't know. I mean, I really liked the...
Social Network, the plot is the character.
I liked Morgan Freeman in Seven. I thought that was a pretty interesting
character. Part of the plot, and he's there to be... he's the Jiminy Cricket on Brad Pitt's shoulder, who's like kind of telling him why this is happening this way, and this is the thing about the city, and this is what you got to know about this job. And
maybe because he's that character. The last time I saw the movie, I also read the script, and I think the script makes it more about him than
see, what you're doing is you're putting the Fincher on a pedestal. Think I like Fincher more than I actually do.
You're a well-versed student in Fincherisms. That's okay. About Social Network, I guess. No, I understand. You're, it's about because those characters are gimmicky and cold, and that's the way people are these days, and so it makes sense that it's a modern story.
It worked well that it's about someone who's supposedly cold. Yeah. I mean, the thing is, The Social Network isn't gimmicky. There's no gimmick to it. It's not...
It's got a handful of gimmicks in it.
Like what?
And the film?
Yeah.
Well, like the all the editorial choices are gimmicks to elicit a certain point of analysis or a certain sort of character relationship.
That's as straightforward a film as you're going to get for the most part. Okay. If you didn't know that those guys were digital twins, how weird would you think it was filmed, actually?
Well, nothing about the weird way that it's filmed, but, I mean, I don't know. We're going in a weird direction here. I don't even know what I'm talking about.
Are you talking about cinematography?
No, I'm talking about the characters. That's what we're talking about, right? I'm talking about the characters. The characters in Social Network.
A gimmick is a normal guy who likes to meet a nice girl, except for every time he touches them, they burst into flame.
Oh, you're talking about like high concept gimmicky.
There's no concept. The film is low concept. It's about the characters. Yeah, that's why it's a low concept.
Okay, fine.
High concept is the game. Yeah. It's about the thing.
Well,
you have
to explain a whole big thing that has to happen. Okay.
High concept is The Hangover. Three guys wake up in a hotel room and they don't remember what happened the night before and they have to find the groom. That's the high concept. That's the gimmick.
Okay. No, I get you.
So he's graduated. People were saying he was trying to graduate he was obviously trying to graduate when he did Benjamin Button.
But that was such a gimmicky concept.
Absolutely. So it was baby steps for him. Yeah. But, you know, it was nominated for a lot of things. I don't know what's going to happen with Social Network. I mean, does it deserve Oscar nominations? I haven't seen everything that came out this year. I can't tell you for sure. People are saying that things like Winter's Bone are you know, better. But if you look at most, you know, the critics are not the Academy. It's different types of people. Most critics lists have Social Network somewhere in the top three, you know?
Yeah, it's pretty high. A lot of people are, just because it's Darren Aronofsky or whatever, loving Black Swan for Best Movie of the Year. Just regular people.
I think most.
And I still have to like check and check.
I mean, the thing is, you know what kind of films the Academy likes. You know, and it's not.
It has to do with which way the wind blows that year.
It's not the big thing. I mean, are you telling me that the year that the hell did it beat?
Hurt Locker was an interesting.
Shakespeare in Love beat Saving Private Ryan for Best Picture. I mean, that's a travesty. That's the Academy's. You know, they're not infallible.
It's a plurality, and there's more. You know, so there's a lot to it. I don't know. I think for Zodiac, the thing that really comes down to it for me about giving it like a high rating, and I think I'll give it a 4 out of 5. That sounds like a really solid, reliable rating.
That's about what I'd give it.
It is messy in places. I watched the director's cut, which is almost 3 hours. I never felt like it was long, which for a first time watching something, things almost always feel the longest the first time you watch them, because you kind of never know what's going to happen next, and everything is fresh.
I think that makes it feel shorter.
Really?
Yeah.
The first time watching this?
The second time since I know what's happening, I start noticing that it's taking forever.
I'm weird like that. I can see what you're saying there, and I think sometimes it's always shorter for me the second time I watch something, but there are places, like if I know and anticipate a slow part, there are places where I am like Sonic the Hedgehog when you don't push the, go right button. And I do kind of like tap my foot.
He taps his watch.
Yeah.
Does he look at his watch upside down?
I don't remember if he's an intellectual or not.
I'm pretty sure Sonic wouldn't do that. Yeah. I think Sonic does it like 90% of people.
Yeah, exactly, right?
He's not Bruce Willis.
No. Does Bruce Willis wear his watch?
Yeah, John McClane looks at his watch upside down in the Die Hard films.
Interesting.
At least in 3.
Yeah.
Which I watched recently.
But just that that it works, that they take so much stuff from, I mean, it's a true crime story with a variety of characters, and like you said, they have to kind of manage the telling of the story of these crimes and this incident and this sort of fear, and they have to kind of pick their battles and choose with which character is interesting to go with for a while, and then they switch it or whatever, and they made all the right decisions here to make what I feel is a good, compelling film. You could have made it about any one of those police officers and just told their story. You could have made it about just the cartoonist. But they pick and choose, and that makes it a bit of a mess, but the consistency of the through line of the story works in the way that they break it down. And who knows, maybe that was a really easy thing to do, but I don't think it would have been, because people screw up straight-up formula in a general, like, you know, protagonist-antagonist drama all the time. So to accomplish something as complex as this and have it, you know, work for 70-80% of what it does is pretty big.
I think that, gosh, it's been so long since I've talked about my theory of 2007. It's a 2007, right?
The bumper crop, you mean?
The bumper crop. The reason why it doesn't get the love that the other films do that year is because it was released in, like, January.
Zodiac?
Yeah, they killed it. They killed it for Oscars. They killed it.
Oh, you mean it came out in the bumper crop? It was in 2007?
Yeah, I think so.
It was like 2006 or 5 or something.
It might have been, but I could have sworn it was 2007, and they released it at the beginning of the year.
Mm. Yeah, I mean,
2007.
Okay.
Bumper crop. It's the bumper crop, and it was released in, like, January.
We're watching it now in January of 2011, and crappy weather and everything else, it fits a January. It's a winter movie.
Right.
It's a dark, dismal, kind of dreary movie. It's not a hopeful... Despite that scene, oh, man. I read people... I was kind of underwhelmed by it, but the scene with the couple being killed in the when they're out at the lake or whatever.
The couple doesn't get killed, just the girl.
Oh, yeah. Just the girl, which just seems so... It's so twisted and weird. That whole thing is just bizarre.
Yeah.
But that looked like such a nice day. But that's so sad, you know?
Yeah.
It's like,
but isn't that great? Like, the tension, like, he does something with it. Anyone can do a thing where, I mean, the Coen brothers do it, like, that scene where, in No Country for Old Men, where Bardeen has Woody in the chair, and he's just got the gun sitting on him for a long time, and he's talking to him. And then the time comes when you know he's going to shoot him, and they just wait for a few seconds.
Uh-huh.
And then finally, poof, and the chair goes, poof, and he,
exactly.
Yeah, but, and that's, like, tension for a little while, but while they're talking, you know if it's going to happen. But the way he does it is, like, it's kind of goofy.
Yeah.
The characters are, the guy is saying too much, and the girl's looking at him like, will you shut up?
Yeah, exactly.
And he's like, and then he's, like, egging the guy on, kind of.
Uh-huh.
And, like, not thinking he's for real. And then the guy, like, he's aiming at him. He looks goofy. He's kind of schlubby looking.
Yeah.
But he's got on the mask and everything.
And he's got his little insignia, which is the stupidest
thing. Yeah, and he's, you know, he's holding a gun, but it never looks that menacing.
No.
And then suddenly he just walks back and starts, but the whole time, like, then he cuts to that angle I was telling you about, the shot that's close on their faces.
Mm-hmm.
And you start to think, man, something, like, despite the fact that they're arguing with each other, like, there's some, he just is able to draw out this tension on something that they kind of inject, like, a little bit of humor into it.
Yeah, exactly.
Make it seem like this shouldn't be frightening, but it really is utterly terrifying, because you have no idea what the person is going to do.
Yeah.
And I think that's a good way to tell you about most serial killers. Serial killers aren't like hulking, like, I'm going to kill you. People who, like, storm right at you with, like,
the relationship weirdos. Between emotion and action isn't always
connected. Yeah, they're just weirdos, and you're like, who's this creep? You know?
Yeah. Why?
And then he ends up stabbing you.
Why are you okay to just sit in the corner and be okay? Like, well, people are here. Like, you know, there's a lack of an awareness of the awkwardness of situations. I guess. I mean, I don't really know. I haven't profiled a lot of serial killers. I think the truth of the matter is that there's all kinds of people that do all kinds of creepy, weird shit.
How many serial killers do you think listen to this podcast?
I sure hope none.
Would you say that they're all latent homosexuals?
all the serial killers that listen to this podcast are? I don't know. They never really get into his assessment of that, at least in the movie. It looks like it's accurate, but they never get into it.
I don't know. He was into that chick. He touched some kids, but I mean, come on, who hasn't?
They make the point that all of this is happening over such a long period of time that even though it does completely obsessively occupy the Gyllenhaal character's life towards the end of the movie, it wasn't doing that the whole time, you know?
Well, because he folded his family into his obsession.
Yeah.
And, I mean, it makes some sort of statement about, you know, what obsession does. I mean, every time you see Ruffalo's character at work, he's being rousted from
being awake.
Sleep with his wife, you know, and here they go with the stupid serial killer again.
Uh-huh.
I'll get back to what matters, kids
and the wife.
That's all that matters.